Next on The Old Mole, we launch our new Mole segment on public health and the pandemic. Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg will discuss this morning ways of looking at infectious diseases from a public health versus medical model perspective.
This is Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg, focusing today on the public health response to the pandemic and what's been lacking or overlooked. Much of the news on the pandemic traces the race for a vaccine with vast investments and resources in this new mad dash for what is held out as the only reliable path out of the pandemic. Well, Patricia, as a physician and public health professional, what's your assessment of the various claims circulating around vaccines and their hopes and promises, and what we can draw from the history of vaccination and immunization programs?
First, let me say good morning, Jan. I'm really happy that you invited me to have this discussion because these are issues I've thought about for a long time. And what I'd like to start with is my reflection on something that I read in a public health blog about understanding vaccines. And there was a statement that they made in there, and I'll just read it to you. There is no working vaccine for HIV, malaria, or tuberculosis. Consequently, these diseases continue to kill millions in the world. Now, I find that a very misleading and almost untrue statement. I want to say first that I am not an anti-vaxxer. I believe very much in vaccination as a very important public health tool. But the fact that we don't have vaccines for this trio of diseases is not the reason for their not being controlled. It's really all about the social conditions under which these diseases flourish. And things like poverty and hygiene and poor access to medical care are the reasons why TB, HIV, and malaria are still with us. So let's go back in history a little bit more, maybe to the 16th century England. And the records indicate perhaps up to a third of all kids perished by the age of 15, and they were dying from infectious diseases like dysentery, scarlet fever, whooping cough, influenza, smallpox, pneumonia, and clearly kids aren't dying like that now. If you go back just a century or 120 years ago in this country to the 1900s, the three leading causes of death were tuberculosis, pneumonia, and dysentery. Today, obviously, that's not true. The leading causes of mortality are heart disease and cancer. But what happened in between to defeat infectious disease was not immunization programs. It was all the classic public health measures, and it had to do primarily with living conditions, hygiene, housing, nutrition, clean water. If you look at the line of infectious disease cases as it's going down over time, you find that that line starts to go down long before there were any immunizations introduced. And then in mid-20th century, when the immunizations are programs start to be introduced, you see another little downward dive, but it's minimal compared to the effects that these classic public health measures had on controlling infectious disease.
Maybe we can talk some as little later about why these public health measures have often been marginalized. It's what Ivan Illich, the sociologist who wrote so much about the history of medicine, called shadow labor, the kind of work that you only see when it's not being done.
Right.
And so
right.
much of public health we're seeing now, because ordinarily these are programs that are kind of assumed in a way, but have been underfunded versus the medical system that is impressive in many ways around specialty and the technology-driven
right.
aspects of healthcare, but is lacking, as we know, in many other areas. How would you situate this issue of vaccines and immunizations within the healthcare system versus the public health system? And how would you compare those two models for looking at wellness and illness?
Well, let's just take the COVID, the current pandemic. I think that it's very obvious what is needed now to control the spread of COVID. There's widespread agreement on this, are the classic public health measures. But because of...
Can you just briefly say what may not be obvious, but what are those main principles that have been established for some time? Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. 90% of the transmission of COVID is occurring in closed indoor spaces. So we're talking about prisons. We're talking about call centers. We're talking about big workplaces like meatpacking plants. We're talking about detention centers, homeless shelters,
nursing homes,
all those places where people are confined indoors and breathing the same air over long periods of time. And the way that you control that, of course, is through social distancing. It's through managing airflow. It's through wearing masks. It's by decreasing the density of those populations. Those are the classic public health measures. And there are other things like just the general health of the population. When your nutritional status is poor, when you have a lot of underlying disease because of exposure to pollution, et cetera, then you're going to have more infections and people are not going to do as well with those infections.
Is this also related to the vaccine controversies in that public health also takes a more socialized view of our health and well-being, that what we do affects others? The vaccination is about vaccinating your kids is a commitment to the larger good. And
precisely.
Medical model tends to be more focused on the individual and an immediate set of determinants to illness.
When you talk about the project of medicine, you're talking about taking care of an individual patient. And the questions that you're asking yourself as a doctor or a nurse or whatever is, what is making this person sick? What can this person do to be healthier? What treatments are appropriate for this person? You might think a little bit about prevention, but that's not the strong suit of medicine. So the point of view of medicine is that disease comes out of bad genes, bad behavior, and bad luck. And it's all about marshaling the forces of medical science to save people, sometimes from themselves. And that's the kind of thinking that is coming to the fore now in the face of this pandemic. What's going to be the best treatment? What's going to be the best ventilator? When are we going to have our vaccine, et cetera? But we find that medical care approach doesn't work very well. And there's pretty broad agreement in the literature that if you're talking about excess morbidity and mortality, which is a fancy phrase for preventable disease and death, then medical care accounts for about 10% of preventing that excess morbidity and mortality. That's not very much.
Are you saying also with the coronavirus?
I think that's probably true also of the coronavirus, although treatment, once people get the disease, medical science, of course, is extremely important. But the percentage of cases that actually get to a hospital and need treatment is pretty tiny. It's hard to know because so many patients, so many people with the disease are asymptomatic, and we really don't know how many have been infected. It's hard to know what percentage wind up needing treatment. So it's hard to guess about that.
There seems to be a tremendous focus on the acute care of people who are very ill on ventilators and either die or require emergency intensive care. And then on the other end of the spectrum are these asymptomatic, perhaps super spreaders who seem not ill at all. There is very little that I've seen on where to locate people between those two extremes. And is that important? I mean, there are people who might be mildly sick.
Yeah, there probably is a huge reservoir of people who are mildly sick. Some people are estimating that up to 40% of the infections are asymptomatic and that therefore spreading the disease without knowing it.
With and just of course, low-level symptoms that even with this now, the pandemic are still contagious, but don't become critically ill for a number of reasons related to underlying vulnerabilities.
I think actually from a transmission point of view, the more important issue or problem is the people who do get sick, but in the 2 or 3 days leading up to when they get sick, their viral loads in their blood, in their lungs, or whatever is rising and rising. And right as they become ill, their viral loads are at their peak, very large. And that is when they are really most contagious. And it's probably those folks who get sick who are doing more of the spreading because they're around people. They don't know they're sick, and people don't know that recognize that they're sick. And so they're spreading it during that period. People who don't really get sick may not be as infectious, but this is not something that we really know.
How would you address these patterns of transmission from a public health standpoint? And what are some of the dynamics in the capitalist economy where we're living this out that affect these patterns of transmission and infection?
Right. Well, I think you have to go back to basic principles of public health, and that's the case identification, the contact tracing, the testing, and all of that is a mess. It's been poorly handled right from the get-go. And we can talk a little bit about all of that, but I think it's been pretty well covered in the mainstream media. I would like to get on to that question about why the public health response has been so attenuated and why people are grasping on to that techno fix, that hope for a vaccine, etc. And I think a big reason behind that is that the fortunes of public health have been declining in this country for well over 2 or 3 decades. Most recently, we saw Trump, for example, 2 months before the coronavirus was thought to break out in Wuhan, he ended a $200 million pandemic early warning program that was aimed at training scientists in China and other countries to detect and respond to exactly this kind of threat. And they had, in the couple of decades that they had operated, they had identified 1,200 viruses with the potential to leap over into the human population and cause a pandemic. More recently, Trump proposed a federal budget that was going to cut $25 million from public health preparedness and response. But I think it's a real mistake to think that Trump is the problem here, because this cutting back on public health and public health preparedness has been going on really since the Reagan era, which is when we first saw that radical return to the logic of the market that was characterized by deregulation of industry, defunding of the public sphere, the privatization of public services, the undermining of worker rights. And it is at this point when you start to see a decline year after year after year in public health spending. And that accelerated even after 2008. And this is during the Obama administration. So you end up with a situation today where public health spending is 2.5% of all the healthcare spending in the U.S., which is sort of a shocking figure. Just to put that in another context, the U.S. military budget exceeds the budget of the CDC by a factor of about 130 times. So the U.S. was really caught flat-footed when it faced this pandemic. You had cuts at every single level, the local, state, and federal level in public health, in the public health infrastructure, ability to respond quickly and massively and appropriately to this pandemic.
Well, given that the economic imperatives driving the healthcare system and starving public health initiatives, what about now the race for a vaccine? On the one hand, many of the vaccines that have failed, and with Ebola, there was a limited effort because the pharmaceutical companies didn't think it was worth the investment. But there is a lot of capital going into this search for a vaccine. It will likely be profitable.
So oh, yeah.
How do we reclaim public health from the profit-driven institutions and corporations and even entities within our own government that collude in this form of inequality?
Well, I think that's an opportunity that we actually have within the context of this pandemic, because I think the pandemic has torn some of the clothes off the emperor, as they say. And it's an opportunity to point out that a very debilitated public health system has not served us well. And it's debilitated because it's part of big government. I think it's also debilitated because it has that potential to expose the externalities of commercial and industrial processes. And big companies don't want to have to be responsible for the public health problems that they create. Public health represents the commons, and public health problems require sweeping policy changes and big investments, and that is anathema to the current powers that be. So we have an opportunity now, I think, to point out within the context of this pandemic the very real price that we pay for that debilitation of our public health services.
And that what you're describing is more than just access to health care, Medicare for all.
Oh, absolutely. No, we need to vastly beef up our public health systems from every level, from the local health departments who are responsible for doing things like contact tracing, to the state level and emergency preparedness, to the CDC, to the international level. We have the capacity to detect these viruses before they leap over into the human community. And that's what we should be doing. But we're not funding that activity anymore.
Well, let's perhaps take that up and see what we can understand about that potential for prevention that's always part of the public health model, or it's central to the public health model. So let's continue with this story of the pandemic through the lens of public health and what the openings are through this crisis and what we have to keep an eye on as we organize for a healthy return to normalcy?
Well, I think we're in a situation where the public has really lost confidence in the ability of this system to protect and preserve their health. So it's a very interesting moment. So what I would like to talk more about is a few different themes. One is that scientific progress is not the same as social progress, and that scientific progress by itself is not going to save us. I also think that I want to point out that healthcare systems reflect the social relations of the larger society, and that those healthcare systems are going to succeed and fail in exactly the same ways. And lastly, I think building healthy communities is fundamental to the project of remaking our societies into ones that privilege the health and well-being of the people over the well-being of capital. So some of those are some of the things that I'd like to explore as we talk further.
Okay, let's do it. This is Jan Hocken and Patricia Kohlberg talking today about the public health response to the pandemic and how we need to organize for a better response.